welcome to another Dishcast. It's a unusually hot and summery day here in Washington, D.C. We've had a little blast of hot weather, and I just want to start by thanking you all for subscribing, to ask you to continue to keep subscribing, and if you're listening to this and haven't subscribed for some reason, you'll be cut off about an hour into this podcast. And if you want to hear everything else that my guest is going to say, you need to subscribe. So please do. We're doing really well, actually. We're 21,000 paid and 161,000 altogether, which is more than I could possibly ask for. And not only that, they're good 20,000 and a great 160,000. So thank you for that. To give you an idea of what's coming up, Adam Moss is coming on, my old editor, probably I think the greatest editor of his generation. He's done a book called The Work of Art, which is about the artistic process. Anyway, that'll be fun. George Will is coming on to talk about Trump and conservatism. Johan Hari, my old friend, he's coming on. He's just done a new book on Ozempic, the weight loss drugs. He's going to talk about all of those. And I have, maybe I shouldn't say this, but I think I may start Ozempic.
You should.
Why the hell not? After reading his book. And I need to get rid of my belly, because everything else works, but the belly doesn't. Anyway, we also have Noah Smith coming on, a really fascinating kind of fresh voice online on the economy. Nellie Bowles, the hilarious wife of Barry Weiss, and she's writing about the woke revolution and how it changed her. Bill Maher is coming on, finally. Well, not finally. He came on as soon as we asked him. But because I've been on his show, obviously, a bunch of times, and even did his podcast where we talked a great deal about the mechanics of anal sex, which apparently he's completely obsessed with. And then Van Jones is coming on. So we've got some superstars coming up on the Dishcast. And just a heads up, next week, we're actually going to take off. It's going to be our spring break week. We've been putting out a dish every day, every week since, every day, feels like every day, every week since January. And we're going to take a little break. I got to go see my mom back in England. And Chris is going to take a well-deserved little, and he's got his birthday. I forget. Yeah, he's got his birthday. And he's going to take a well-deserved birthday break. But this week, someone who has profiled and destroyed various superstars, the indefatigable journalist Kara Swisher. She's a journalist who's covered the business of the internet since 1994, from the very start of online media. She was the co-founder and editor-at-large of Recode. And she's worked for the New York Times, the Washington Post, and the Wall Street Journal. And she's now the host of the podcast On with Kara Swisher and the co-host of the Pivot podcast with Scott Galloway, both distributed by my old place, the New York Magazine. But her new memoir, which is a bestseller, and which is a really fun and racy read, which I really recommend, it's called Burn Book, a tech love story. Kara,
hi.
Thank you so much.
Good to see you.
It's been a long time.
I know. We've known each other for a dog's age. I don't even remember where we met. We were young.
Long, long time ago.
Well, we were in our 20s, I think.
We were. We're in our early 20s. Yeah. I remember, this is the one thing I do remember, Kara, is we went to from the first ever National Lesbian Gay Journalists Association.
Probably the only two, but go ahead.
There were more. There were a few ones. Who was the dude? It was
at mainstream publications. There weren't. They weren't out. There were not as many people.
Oh, were almost
out.
No one was out.
Right. But a lot of it was like Advocate and that kind of gay publications. And then we were from.
There were a handful, a sprinkling of people from within the mainstream who weren't prominent enough to have to be out publicly, but they were out privately.
Right.
And I was just by accident, because I got a job very young, and I realized I was the only sort of openly gay person.
I was the other openly. You remember use the word openly? Yeah,
but that's,
openly.
You remember.
Yeah, right? I mean,
do. I think it's really hard for people today to
comprehend. That you couldn't say. I mean, I came out very early, as you did too, but it was hard at the time to do so, and everyone found it fascinating, and then they would ask all kinds of dumb questions. But you know, I thought it was, you also thought it was important to be out, and so did I. We also were like, we're fantastic. It wasn't like, you know what I mean? It wasn't like, oh, let me tell you something horrible about myself.
No, and but it was important for me at the same time, and I'm sure this was also true, to be like, yes, I'm gay, yes. Now, can we talk about my job? Can we talk about what I'm trying to cover? But I remember I did an interview with Time magazine. And mm-hmm. Mike Duffy, if you remember him. Anyway,
sure do.
He did a piece when I got named editor of the New Republic. And we talked for about an hour and a half. And then as he was leaving, he just said, oh, and you're gay, right? Mm-hmm. And I'm like, yeah. Mm-hmm. Oh, okay. The piece begins, outspokenly gay activist Andrew Sullivan has been named editor of the New Republic. He's turning the whole place homosexual. Anyway, yeah. It was... You dealt with that for a while.
I really liked those white parties at the New Republic. They were great.
If only.
You weren't that outspoken.
I was at the white party, but somewhere else.
Yeah, exactly.
Karen, tell us where you grew up, about your parents.
Yeah, you mentioned
obviously
that.
Had a pretty rough childhood, actually.
Rough in emotion, not
in most
comfort.
Important way possible.
Yes. You know, my dad died when I was 5. He was in the Navy. He had just gotten out of the Navy, and he died of a cerebral hemorrhage very suddenly when I was 5. We were very close. And you only figure that out, how devastating it is, once you have children and you know them. I just left my 2-year-old, and he knows me incredibly well. And so it was really devastating in a way that it took me many, many decades to figure out. But we were in New York, in the New York area, in Long Island, in a place called Roslyn Harbor. And my mom remarried pretty quickly to a really terrible person who was cruel to us. And my other brother was 7. My other brother was 3. My mom, you know, was widowed at 32, 33. So married.
Your father was 34 when he died.
Right, 34. For just
and it wasn't
out of the blue.
You were there.
Yes, I was there. So, not when he died, actually. He died weeks later.
Yeah.
But when he had the hemorrhage and we were trying, he would make us breakfast every Sunday and he wouldn't get up is the thing. And so we tried to get him up. My brother tried to get him up. He had locked the door. He had a headache.
Why had he locked the door?
Because he had a headache. He wanted to sleep.
Okay.
He wanted to sleep
in. Didn't want to be bothered by
kids. There are 3 kids, 3 okay. little kids, yeah, right? Yeah. They'd run in and jump on him. And so he was trying to... He had worked the night before on a speech that he was giving. He had just gotten a job as the head of anesthesia at Brooklyn Jewish Hospital. So he was, you know, preparing for his new life, essentially, because the Navy, had paid for his education. So he had served for a long time. And he had just, you know, he came from a modest upbringing. So it was the way he got ahead, essentially. And he had served all over the place. And, you know, even like Santo Domingo, he was in like actions there. But it was a doctor, essentially. And so, you know, he was praying for his new life. He had just bought a house. We were living in a rental house. He had just bought a house because he had money for the first time, or enough money to put a down payment on a house. And he just had a bad headache and then didn't wake up. Woke up a little bit in the hospital, from what I understand, but didn't recognize anybody because his brain swelled and he wouldn't have survived. I mean, today he might have survived and been okay, but then you didn't.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. It's a terribly traumatizing thing
it
to
is.
Go through. And you kind of wanted to be in the military yourself.
Yes, I did. Yeah. You know, traumatizing in the way
young
that
it's a lesbian thing to want.
Yeah,
to
I know.
Do.
I did. I totally did. But I have a lot of family in the military on my father's side, for sure. One of my great grandfathers was an admiral at some point. And so it was, you know, they thought of the military as a positive thing. So did I. I thought it was something that brings us together, and that why should, you know, we had some wealth, not when my dad was living with my stepfather. And I was like, why can't wealthier people be in the military? Why shouldn't that happen? And so I thought I'd be good at it. I was very interested in military intelligence. I was always interested in propaganda. I just spent a lot of time thinking about that and intelligence.
You studied the Nazis in college,
and I studied China and all the different ways propaganda were used. Because one of the things that's interesting is we use all these terms now, misinformation, disinformation, whatever it happens to be, but it's propaganda, which has been around since the beginning of time. I mean, Caesar used propaganda, everybody used propaganda. And so I had been very interested in that. I had thought it would be good to be in the military, but you couldn't, as you know. It wasn't, you actually got arrested at one point, I think, while I was still interested. And then it was don't ask, don't tell. Thank you, Bill Clinton, which was almost worse.
It was worse.
Way.
They got rid of more people under
separate,
that policy.
But equal. That's what it felt, you know.
Oh, it was
felt
worse.
Like it was worse. And I'm not sure it was worse than that. But so it was sort of this idea that you were, that if you don't say anything, we'll let you in, which was repulsive.
But what's striking to me at the time, I'd actually dated an Air Force captain, my first guy I dated. His dad was in the military. And so I got to know a few, and there were so many gay guys in the military.
So many.
In the 90s here or the 80s here, and it was very military, and everywhere I went was full of soldiers. It was For me, it was incredibly hot. Actually.
It was so dumb. Why wouldn't they be good soldiers? It was so and lesbians. Hello, of course we're going to be good soldiers. So you know, I wasn't able to do that. So and I thought about doing the State Department, but at the time, if you recall, I went to Georgetown Foreign Service School. There was the whole Clinton Lone Tree thing. Do you remember all the spying in the Russian embassy?
Right,
he had a girlfriend that he let in the secret room, and there was sort of a gay panic that continued. You know, you've seen the. You know, fellow travelers, that's a really good.
Well, the State Department, you know, was always chock-a-block.
Chock-a-block of gays, right.
And from the 50s onwards, they were, it was the State Department that they really went after.
Right, right, exactly.
Jamie Kirchick's book really details
that. Right, that was a great book. I interviewed him about that.
What a great book.
And so I just was like, oh God, this is exhausting. Like, I just can't. And at this point, you know, AIDS was, we're in the midst of AIDS. And as you recall, I think even if you weren't an activist, it was like, that's fucking enough with you people. Like, why do we have to put up with this shit? And I remember doing that in my personal life, you know, not being apologetic. Just when the AIDS quilt was here, I was one of the people that folded it, if you remember, which was an astonishing experience.
I do very well.
It was beautiful. It was, and the way the gay community reacted to it, I thought was great. It was sort of like, what are we going to do, essentially?
And so I wasn't. And the way lesbians were also very much involved in a way they didn't have to be as such. Because
you could hide. You could hide.
Absolutely, you could hide. Mm-hmm. No, it's hard to remind people today what it felt like to be gay then.
Yeah, furtive. So bad for you personally. And
yet at the same time, and also terrifying because so many people were dying. And there was this hideous culture of death.
Right. And then you had the Reagan administration. Because for a while, when I started college, I actually had a Reagan poster up because I believe in hope, right? I'm kind of like, I'm attracted.
I went to a Reagan rally.
But it wasn't, but the AIDS stuff, I was like, what do you do? Like, it was so stupid from a talent point of view, from a resource point of view. And it seemed so dumb at the time that it was, one of the things that really got to me was, you know, of course, Angels America affected me. All kinds of things affected me. But at that time, to me, it was a waste of, like, I didn't even understand it. It sort of made me a lot the way I am. It was like, okay, if you're going to not like me for good reasons, dislike me for good reasons, right? Not for these reasons. And it seemed as if I was always proud of being gay. I don't know about you. I was not ashamed of it at all.
Well, I was, I guess, before I came out. And then having wrestled with it in college, really, after college, I then came out and almost instantly I had absolutely no issues with it whatsoever. Right. Once I figured out myself that obviously this wasn't, there was nothing wrong with this, obviously. Mm-hmm. And when it actually felt incredibly right for the first time, fuck these people.
Right. And it was used in ways, you know, I remember someone saying, oh, you don't like men or something. And I was like, I don't have to sleep with them. So I don't see why that would be. I like them a lot. Like I have no problem with men. But, you know.
Au contraire. You kind of like hanging out with them.
Exactly. And actually, I did get along, especially at the Washington Post when I was there, got along with men better. And there was something was missing, the sort of tension or what, not the sexual tension, but the tension, some sort of tension that straight men and women seem to have sometimes. And one of the things that was interesting, though, they still were sort of living in the idea of the tropes of gays, which drove me crazy. That was the other thing. I knew so many different kinds of gays. And I was at Georgetown, so you had the Young Americans for Freedom, and that was full of gays, you know, all those people. And
we did a podcast on all the gay right-wingers and stuff. Because it's randomly distributed.
Right, exactly.
Of course, and so it's going
to
have
So I kept saying to, you know, they always had these ideas about gays that just drove me nuts. And at one point, I quoted Walt Whitman to them. I go, we contain multitudes. Like, and they were like, what? And I'm like, oh, my God, Walt Whitman. Like,
the number of times I have to explain, yes, you know, I can be gay and I can also be a Catholic and I can also be, I can be other things
as
well.
That's tougher, but I'm Catholic, too. But I found that tougher. But
well, it was definitely a challenge.
Faith is what you're talking about, having faith.
Yeah, and sticking with that faith, even as you see the silliness of the institutions.
Well, try being at Georgetown. Well, I mean, all the priests were sleeping with the students, and then they were they had gay people at Georgia University. They sued. They got it was like, what? I kept going, what?
I know.
Like, what's happening? And I didn't want to be angry about it. Like, how dare you? I wasn't that kind of gay, like, or lesbian. And I was just like, you're fucking ridiculous. This is so silly.
But I would wear, I would wear a T-shirt with a pink triangle on it, and I would go to Mass and go to communion with it.
Yeah. Oh, good.
There was an element of like that.
Yeah, yeah.
Because I remember working out at the YMCA with Anderson Cooper back in the day when we were both like 12.
Yeah.
And he was freaked out by my T-shirt.
What are you doing?
What are you doing? Why do you have to...
Come on. We have such good swag. The gays have such...
Well, the design.
Right, exactly.
ACT UP's design.
Amazing.
Was amazing.
Yeah.
And
the humor and the plays and the art was so, you know, some of it was angry, some of it was funny. But what drove me crazy were the tropes about gays, which just weren't, you know, every lesbian's from the well of loneliness or, you know what I mean? Like, oh, we're going to just commit suicide next week altogether. That drove me nuts. Even at the Post, there's a thing in the book where they were doing some gay trope picture, like some gay trope picture. And look, those gays exist. I didn't mean, but they're not all of them. And so I actually stole, because in the days you used to have photographs that were physical. They weren't digital pictures. I took it and I put it in my desk so they couldn't use it again, because they kept using it when it was gays. And
you
I
know,
like,
they have the for gay pride parade, they have somebody in a bikini and a...
And that exists. I was just in the cast chair the other day. Their naked guy was there. There's no question.
No, they're absolutely there. And there's no reason... But there should be some balance, some variety.
Right, suit guy was there, naked guy was there. You know, like, it just... Anyway.
I don't go to pride much but
I don't
anymore.
Either. But I sometimes call it shame. Yeah. My friends are
so
like...
So you're part... Yes. I think
I
our
like
generation...
Gabby.
Feels that way in a sense.
I'm no fun. I, let's just admit it. We're no fun. That's
I'm not fun. I hate the carnival parade, for example.
I just find the
idea of walking down the street and parading yourself to be...
I don't like any
how
parades.
How old are you all?
We don't like any parades.
I don't care.
I don't. Although I took one of my sons to one here, actually, and he was like, nobody's tried to pick me up. What's wrong? And I was like, sorry, I don't know what to do.
I took my mother to one once. Jesus Lord, why did I do that? That was when I was very young. And she said hilariously, she said with classic understatement, you all do seem very affectionate with one another. What got you into journalism?
Because I couldn't do that. I couldn't be in, you know, there's not, spies are like journalists, right? Thinking things up, thinking, getting all kinds of information, trying to make sense of it, trying to get to the truth. They don't always, by the way, but trying to figure things out. And so
you're a reporter.
I was
more
a reporter.
Than
I was a beat
else.
Reporter, and right. I still, well, I haven't done as much as I used to, but I certainly, like, I spent today doing a long interview about the China threat, right, with two really great people. But so I do reporting now, but it's more through interviews. But I was a beat reporter, really was. I covered the Haft family here in Washington, if you remember them. I covered retail, the decline of retail. That's how I got to the Haft family. And so I wasn't in...
Oh, the Haft family.
The Haft, yeah,
oh
I did that.
God, with the hair.
That was mine. Those were all my stories.
That was the hair.
The hair, right. But one of the things that got me into it, I didn't do it in high school, but when I was in college at Georgetown, I did not want to go to Georgetown. It was a backup at the time, and now it's not, but it was at the time. And I was sort of like, oh, I'm in this Catholic school. The teachers were fantastic, I have to say, especially the Jesuits that were taught me. But I didn't like it, and I was applying to leave because it was sort of this drunken, straight culture that I was like, oh, this is exhausting. These people are exhausting. And I didn't drink. I don't drink. And no reason. I just don't. And I don't, like, fornicate with men. So I was like, oh, this is going to suck for me.
Tedious,
right? And so I started working for the Hoya, which is their student newspaper there. And I did really well. I won the award that year that senior usually got. And I was like, oh, I'm good at this kind of thing. And then I worked for the Post while I was in college. So that's where I worked as a stringer.
And then you went to the Post?
Very quickly. And then worked for John McLaughlin. I worked for all kinds. But I was ultimately from the Post. That's where I did
the
most
John
of my
McLaughlin.
I know.
Maybe people don't remember John McLaughlin. But
well,
he should. But they should. He should.
Cable News owes everything to John McLaughlin.
Who?
Cable News. Screamy cable news.
He basically created... political discourse as comedy drama.
More entertainment.
You know, once again, you have stumbled across the truth, Morton.
Morton. On a scale of 1 to 10, 10 being nuclear Armageddon, how would you assess the recent bill in Congress?
Exit question.
But I used to write, exit question, yes.
Is he going
to
be elected or not?
Well, people...
Eleanor.
You know, one of the things that it was it created sort of this race... It took what was happening in politics, the racehorse elements, the game show elements, and really, it was Twitter before Twitter, right? It was that. And so he was in entertainment. He was a former Jesuit priest, by the way.
Absolutely.
And a sexual harasser, like you can't believe.
Yeah, but he met his match with you.
He did. I never stopped him. He ended up dying before I could kick him.
You are... I mean, one thing I thought was you were fearless.
Yeah.
I mean, you were fearless then with major authority figures. You would talk
back. I wasn't a conservative, so it wasn't like a lot of the people in the office were cowed by him because there was that sort of nascent conservative movement under Reagan, right, as it started to grow there. And he was a major figure. You forget how important he was. Like, he would have people at his parties that, you know, everyone had to, you know, dance to his tune, essentially. And he had a lot of impact with that show that he had on. And so, which was called the McLaughlin Group. And the Five, right? And they had the left people on the left, the right people on the right. Remember, Pat Buchanan was on it.
Was on there all the time. Pat Buchanan and Eleanor Cliff was Jules Drummond.
The other one, Jermond. And then the Novak, who now would seem like a liberal, like, right? Maybe not.
No. I don't think so.
Robert Novak
was like the
dark prince.
The dark. He would just sit there and
glower.
Like, he was a sort of golem.
A nice guy.
Sort of golem figure.
Somewhat of a nice guy. But he, you know, he started that. And I wasn't a conservative, so there was no price for me that I was.
But you were also telling your superiors at the Washington Post.
Yeah.
Like Don Graham. And you don't seem to have.
No.
Any fear of saying these things to people.
Well,
and they seem to take it, even McLaughlin.
Here's why,
end.
Because I don't think people think they have a price and it isn't there. I am very aware of the price. And so either I'm willing to pay the price for what I want to say, or I realize there really isn't one, right? And hasn't Donald Trump kind of shown us that a little bit? Is there a price if you violate things? Now, he goes obviously too far, but, you know, sometimes people edit themselves, and I didn't feel like editing myself. You don't edit yourself particularly.
No. I think in that sense, I have always wanted to say what I think as clearly and as openly as I can, and that is why the internet, as it began
to
emerge,
perfect for us.
Appealed to me. It was like... I'd edited a national magazine. I had gone through all the usual stuff you go through with magazine journalism or newspaper journalism.
Yes, and you were wunderkind, right?
I was a wunderkind to some extent. Yeah. And dealing with an owner, a publisher, dealing with the staff, dealing with all these different, and then advertise. And suddenly there was this possibility that I could just write and on my laptop at home and reach God knows how many people. I remember the incredibly exciting moment when I got my first emails back, which was the other thing. You weren't supposed, I mean, you said you had this anecdote in the Post, like, don't put your email on there. They'll never stop talking to you. And you're like, that's the point.
Right. I think people in the media, all over the media, mainstream eras, they don't like talking to readers. And I love fans and I love people. I don't love rude arguers, and I don't love when they feel like they can just trash or talk to me. Like, I used to get a string of anti-Semitic things during the Haft family, and, you know, it would come in on letters, and they'd write in little red pens around the edges of the thing, which, you know, crazy. I would call those people. They'd always put their phone number on it. That was killed me. They'd say all these incredibly anti-Semitic things, and then they're like, you know, 917, whatever the number was. And I would call them. I'm like, hi, this is Kara Swisher. So, you know, I'm not Jewish, but I think what you said was pretty offensive. And usually people were very apologetic. And that's what I found fascinating. Not everyone. One or two stuck to their guns and had guns, presumably. But they were sort of dyed-in-the-wool anti-Semites and racists. But most people were like, oh, I can't believe I said that. I find that to be the same thing online, not anymore, but for the early days, that certainly was the case, that you had these dialogues you never could have with people. And I've always found the audience smarter than reporters, or they knew things, or they could give you insights. And so one of the reasons people were like, why are you such a good reporter? I said, because I talk to everybody. Like, I don't limit my talking to, reporters like to talk to each other. I never used to like being in the newsroom because it was always like, as you know, these little clatches of people talking at each other. And the most interesting things they sometimes would say to each other and never made it into print, right? That was the other thing, which was so typical of the kind of stuff. We can't write that. I'm like, that's the best part.
Why not?
That's the best part. But I always found, I always liked a relationship with readers, and I continue to this day. I love fans. I talk to them all.
I immediately discovered, you know, that readers, first of all, knew more than I did, obviously, the very nature of a huge number of people. Someone will understand something better because they've had experience and they will say something. And you can pretty quickly figure out if they're bullshitting you or if they know what they're talking about. So I started publishing them as part of the process. And so you then realized, oh, this is a fantastic medium because I can write something, but then I can also air the alternative view
and react.
That's come back and react to that again. And so, and that's been continuous for 25 years. Now we, every week we have dissents. Every week I respond to the dissents because I feel like I learn.
You can learn. Yes, you can. I think some of it's descended into, like, you know, dunking, an endless dunk. But in the beginning, for sure, there was such a, like, stuff I didn't, so many stories that I scoop were from readers.
Yep.
Like, do you didn't know this, or I worked here, or you should know about this. I still get, I got one the other day, and it was 100% factual about something.
And I think in some ways, we currently lament the internet's effect on journalism, but in that respect, it was good. There was a sense of privilege, entitlement, to some extent, condescension to readers that existed in newsrooms, that we are somehow a caste.
Well, it was an opportunity for newspapers to change. That was a great moment. And that's, you know, what happened to us. We left because we couldn't change within the organizations we were in, right? So it was an opportunity for newspapers to embrace that in a way that I have the feeling that if they had done that, the trust in media would be so much higher now, but maybe not.
Yeah, I offered my blog then to the New Republic. They were like, we don't want that.
Yeah.
And then when you, as you developed, both at the Journal, your own beat, as it were, and with Walt Mossberg created this
conference and...
Yes, and a phenomenon really within the Wall Street Journal enterprise,
right?
And in a similar way that I first went to Time and then went to the Atlantic, and when I went to the Atlantic, I doubled their traffic overnight,
right?
So we were in some ways these, I think, really
independent names. That was interesting, and you know, one of the things is that they reacted against that. They didn't like the idea of talent. You had talent in Hollywood. You had famous stars or directors or writers. They did not like that within the news business at all. They didn't like anyone raising their head above the parapet, essentially. And I don't think other reporters liked it either, because they liked sort of being, I never liked being taken care of by daddy, like, oh, daddy's going to pay, or not knowing the finances of what was happening. And one of the things that really changed me was covering retail. You know, I chronicled in this book, I was like, we're fucked, like, especially first with retail, because Walmart came in and didn't do display advertising. The death of local retail here at the Washington, in the Washington area, Garfinkel's, Heckinger's, you know, all these longtime advertisers, and then classifieds. When I saw Craigslist, I literally ran to Don Graham and I'm like, we're fucked. Fucked again. He goes, again? And I go, again. Like, even worse.
So I'm just, how old were you when you were going to Don Graham and telling
early,
you're fucked?
In my 20s and 30s.
You had you had absolutely no fear at all.
He did at least understand. He was on the board of Facebook. I don't know if you remember, but he was. He did understand, and he's a lovely person. So
he is a lovely person.
So he was much more, he was not a hierarchical person either, and he would listen to a lot of people.
Mm-hmm.
I just think that they were sort of steering the ship in a direction, and they didn't, for some reason, I said this to someone the other day, and they were complaining to me about, you know, media deserves this, deserves that. So we deserve nothing. We deserve, it's called the news business. Like, if you don't understand the business part of it, I don't know what you're going to say. Because if you don't make, if your costs don't meet your revenues, you have no right to be there. And maybe the government should fund it. Never happening in this country. Maybe rich people. I don't really want a billionaire to fund me. And then his kids are jerks. Like, who knows what's going to happen?
But it turns out these billionaires don't want to lose money.
They don't. Of course they don't.
They say they do. You go to them and they're like, great, we've got daddy now. And it turns out, no, they don't like losing money.
Who is the New Republic guy, the old rich guy?
Oh, Marty Peretz.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, he just ran out of money.
Right, he ran out of money.
If he had it, he would have given it.
But it was good for him because he liked to go out to parties. And I recall swanning around, a lot of swanning by that guy, right? And if that's what they want it for, but it's just like them owning a yacht or anything else. And so I was like, everything I've done since I left mainstream media, and every now and then I dip back into it, as you did, you know, because I understand its power in some ways. I did that on purpose, went back to the New York
but
Times.
But when you started actually working natively, you develop a kind of sense for readers and for the internet that you, those cultures had not adapted yet to
no,
that.
No.
And they didn't know how to incorporate that. And so I kept butting up against it. And eventually, but again, what were you going to do? Advertising? I could clearly see advertising was not going to work.
Not always. Not always. My podcast does very well. We're sold out for much of the year right now.
I'm talking about programmatic ads.
Oh, yes. No, no. That
in
was
the
clear.
Online yes. era, mm-hmm. that, yeah. that original thing uh-huh. where we thought, well, this is going to be supported by advertising like right. old school newspapers
right.
were. No. And readers weren't giving you any money at that point either. Mm-hmm. They thought
and classifieds were over. And, you know, one of the things they missed, and I definitely got when I was dealing with the early internet people and at AOL, really, is they were seeing everybody as if they were a money maker. Like, you know, how much are we going to make off this person and their privacy, essentially? And they didn't care if it was media. They didn't care if it was a person. They didn't care. And they were just in a business that took advantage of information or data. And for some reason, everybody missed it in media, which was in a business of information, right? That they missed. And they thought the tech people were there to help them. And the tech people were not there to help them. They were there to take their stuff and use it with anything. You know, it was like a bit. It reminds me of, you know, when a better tribe comes over and like takes, you know, when you read any of those accounts of which group goes, you know, Homo sapiens over Neanderthals, you're like, oh, that's what happened. They, you know, they were pretty good Neanderthals.
So when Facebook seemed to be like the savior of mm-hmm. all these big.
I never thought they were, but yeah.
Well, I didn't either. But yeah. Nonetheless, it was deemed to be.
Yes.
And it was crucial to get your Facebook and to get your. Mm-hmm. Of course, that means that you're essentially handing over your fate to an independent party that has no right. necessary interest in your own.
Has none. Absolutely.
Yes, no, none. None. That would be the right word.
None.
Zero.
None. None. And not, more than that, it doesn't. I used to say, like, they don't care if it's Cats or the Wall Street Journal. They don't care. It does. Whatever works is, you know, right now everyone's sort of, and what drives me crazy is everyone's like, can you believe it? I'm like, yeah. Because they did it before. Like this now when Facebook is taking news off of in California over this bill. I was like, well, of course they are, because they're not making enough money from news. And it's no shine off their nose.
If no. They, and they've recently, I mean, I think
as if
the
they
last...
had a duty to have it up there.
Right.
Well, they don't. And no. Because they don't have a duty, because they don't ever feel a duty. They have no civic interest. And maybe they should, but it's like, I'm sorry, they're snakes and they're going to snake. So I don't know what to say. And that often happens with them. It's like they think they're going to, they look at them in terms of, they are media companies. They're just media companies without any sense of responsibility. And I do think media companies are typically run by people who have some sense of responsibility for what they're putting out in the world.
Yes, there were ethics and there was a brand of integrity. There was a kind
of. That. That's part of the plus, right?
Yes, even if you didn't meet it. They were there. And
right.
you sort of saw that as your lodestar. But right. no reason why a tech company like Facebook would feel that way or Twitter would feel
company.
That way.
They are a version of a media company that, you know, this all this debate about TikTok is so funny. I'm like, it's a broadcast company. I don't know what to tell you. It's a broadcast company, just a different kind of one. It's not a tech company. It's a broadcast company. And we either treat it like a broadcast network or we don't. Like, but that's what it is. That's what it's doing. It's broadcasting in a very different way than, say, CBS does. But it's pretty similar as far as I'm concerned.
You also just took an interest in the personalities of the individual characters.
Yeah.
And you, once again, were fearless in talking to them, uh-huh. bugging them, calling them,
texting
them.
Well, they weren't rich before when I met them, just so you're aware. I met them before they were billionaires.
Right.
Way before they were billionaires.
Right.
So that's a very different relationship.
Yes. But nonetheless,
yeah.
they were the key figures. Tell us about a few of them. Tell us, like, what motivated Zuckerberg, do you think? What motivates
well,
him still?
He's interesting. Look, personally, he's lovely. Have you met him?
No.
He's lovely. Let me just say, lovely guy. Like, very awkward, socially awkward, I would say.
A little spectrum-y, maybe?
A little. He's improved, like Gates has. You've met
yeah,
Bill Gates.
I have
yeah, you know, improved. But yes, like everyone knows a socially awkward person. They happen to be. Often in tech, they happen to be. And I think what are the words they're using now? I guess it's autistic in some fashion. And autistic.
Well, they're people who naturally are at home by themselves in front of a screen thinking about abstract things.
Right, or math or whatever. It's kind of a trope, but it's actually true, you know.
Same with Thiel, right?
Right,
same
yes.
with Musk.
Yeah. Yes, they've got elements of that. And so Mark, I met when he was very young, when he was super young, when he had just left Harvard. And I think it was just a few, maybe a few years after that. But he had just started. Facebook was little. It was not a big company. It was, I think it's just starting to become more popular among everybody versus just he went from college to college. And then he did other and then he did the wider stuff. And, you know, he was without filters, you know, which was good. I appreciated that. And he was someone who
what do you mean arrogance. Without filters? You mean
well,
personally?
He said, the thing, first thing he said to me, I heard you think I'm an asshole. And I heard he was an asshole. Actually, he wasn't an asshole, but in my estimation. But he, you know, he was if he was a smooth media guy, he never would have done that, right? Like he wasn't, they were all like that. They were kind of right there. Everything on the inside was on the outside with these people for a long time. They've learned since to, although maybe not, actually, no, they haven't. You know, a lot of what they are was on the surface and it was actually what they were like. And so he was, you know, they needed attention at the time because they media still dominated, right? Whether if I was at the Wall Street Journal and so if I wrote about him, it mattered to them, you know, and from a Wall Street person, they had not gone public. They were still competing with MySpace. They were competing with Friendster, if you remember. So, you know, same thing with Friendster. Musk. He was at a thing called, oh, it was a Yellow Pages company, Zip2, you know, and then they were at PayPal. And he wasn't at PayPal. He was something called X.com, which then merged with PayPal, which I wrote about, too. So they were all struggling as startups. So they needed attention. So that's why they talked to me, really, because they just, you know, a thing in the Wall Street Journal mattered to these companies.
Did Zuckerberg want to be really rich or was he?
No.
He was just fascinated with what this could do.
He was, you know, of all the people, he did study history for his brief second at Harvard and college in high school. Excuse me, he went to a very good high school. But he was obsessed, as you know, with Augustus Caesar, excuse me. And he liked, that was the figure he loved to talk about. And I think in Osno's piece in The New Yorker, he goes on and on about it. But he always liked to.
What about Augustus?
He brought peace and civility. And,
by destroying the Republic.
Everybody. By destroying everybody, yeah.
By basically
I was like, yeah, I'm not sure that,
taking all, taking
I'm not
everything.
Sure the people of Thrace thought that was such a good thing by their toes, you know.
Any attachment to the old Republic. Either.
Right, I mean, that's
this was,
right.
This was a dictator's
well,
takeover.
Well, I think he had a very, it was sort of like, I'm not saying a dummy's guide to history, but it was like, what? Like, no. And I, you know, I pointed that out to him. I'm like, you know, it came at a cost and it was rather high for most people, except for the people in the in crowd. You know, he had a sense, he definitely had a sense of destiny compared to other people. He you know, just the way Steve Case did, I'm going to build this worldwide network of this and that. And they all sort of talk like it. Bezos was the same way when he called it the world's biggest bookstore. I mean, it was, but it wasn't. Technically it was, but it wasn't, right? Because he could get any book. But every bookstore was the world's biggest bookstore, if you really thought, because they could order books from anywhere. And so they all had elements of that, like we're the biggest, we're the best, because they were so small, because they were so, you know, this close to dying kind of stuff. And Facebook was also, you know, in distress. He had hired one executive after another. It didn't work out. Unlike a lot of founders, he was actually good at business. And he is, as you can see now, Facebook shares are up rather significantly. He's a little like Gates in that way. Also good at business, less good at innovation, but good at fast follow and things like that. But he was always very canny about where it was going. And what happened because he got so questioned over the years is he had that sort of stubbornness of someone who is told they are wrong and then something works out. And then, see, I was right. And so he sort of lived in that zone for a long time.
That can calcify into
that's
I am
correct.
Never wrong.
Right.
Which is the beginning of the end.
Right, exactly. Now, look, he got real slapped hard when other companies started to do well, I think. You know, when Snapchat came along. He obviously isn't innovative compared to them. But one of the things he was good at was just sort of buying Instagram, for example, was a very canny move. He sees the talent in others. He never could have created Instagram, I would say. He created one thing, which was a news feed that I think was great, the idea of connecting people. But even Facebook, if you go back, I was telling you earlier about this, there was once, I was always interested in these connection services, because that's, to me, was the greatest part of the internet was connection. Always connect was my constant, I was like, this is really powerful, the ability to, and you know that connecting with your readers or whatever, it depends on what you're doing.
And with my fellow writers. I mean, the other fascinating thing about the early web was that I didn't feel there was any cost to supporting and creating attention to other writers.
That's right. In fact, it was
too.
Better. It was better. Better. It was sort network. Of stone soup, right? That, the internet was stone soup for a long time.
What do you mean stone soup?
Oh, that old, it's an old fable where there's a starving village and the soldier comes and he puts stones in it. And he says, I'm making soup, stone soup. It's going to be delicious. And he starts eating it. Oh, this is delicious. You know, maybe you could use a potato. And one person has a potato, one person has a carrot, one person has celery, one person has an onion, one person has meat. Together, they create the soup that nourishes everyone. Like that, it's a great thing. And then they think it's stone soup, but it's not. It's their soup that they make.
We also felt that just any people reading the internet was a plus.
Right.
And therefore, if you link to someone, the linkage was the other.
The
hyperlink
was
the other. That was the big
leap
forward.
But it really was connecting with people. And I was, in any way you could, and it was interesting because gay people really did get it right away because of hookups, right? They wanted to have sex. Gay men are like the connectingest people ever. Not just AOL chat rooms and things like that. But there was a site called, I told you about this, sex.com. I love that name. I was like, got it.
That's basically.
I know what they're doing here. And I went on it because it was like, hi there. I'm in San Francisco.
This is not the end of this podcast. In fact, we're only just getting going. If you're a paid subscriber and are hearing this, it means you haven't yet signed up for the full new package to get our podcast in full. No extra charge. Just go to andrewsullivan.substack.com/listen, LISTEN, and make sure your podcast is up to date with the Dishcast. You'll be able to add it to your Dishcast feed and never have this hear this message again and go back to exactly what you've been doing for the last 2 years. And I'd like to thank you, too, for contributing for so long. If you're hearing this message and you haven't yet subscribed and want to listen to the rest of the podcast, then just subscribe. It's very easy. andrewsullivan.substack.com is $50 a year. Great value for money. And you also get with that the entire weekly dish every Friday. Not just my weekly column, but also all the comments and dissents on that column. You also have a full discussion of the previous week's Dishcast. So all those questions you had in your mind can be answered, or you can hear and read readers debating what we talked about, sometimes calling me to account. andrewsullivan.substack.com. Subscribe and get the whole thing. Join the debate. Join the fun. Subscribe.